This is the DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg podcast.
I'm a big star, you know.
Listen live weekday mornings from 5 to 8 a.m. on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
Hey, Alexa, play ESPN New York 98.7.
It's DCR.
You must have at least one good Vegas story that might get both of us fired if you told it. You're Chris Canty. I mean, look, I'm the schlunker at the pool with the farmer tan and the man boobs, but you're a former pro athlete with the mirrored sunglasses on, like bottle service, that type of thing. That's the life you live. I can tell.
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely my game plan, B.O.B., but 10 years ago, that version of Chris Canty, can I experiment a little bit? Yeah, we did a lot of experimenting at that time.
This is DCR.
As like the balding, chubby 50-year-old guy that really doesn't blend well at the Hard Rock Party.
On 98.7 ESPN.
Oh, man, to be Chris Canty at like 28 years old in Vegas. You want to talk about living a life with which I am not familiar.
Ooh, it was all good, B.O.B.
Yeah, I have no idea what that even means.
Oh, it was the best.
Mike Tannenbaum's going to join us coming up a little bit later on. 800-919-3776, 800-919-ESPN. Bob Wischusen sitting in with Chris Canty, DCR here on 98.7 ESPN. We've got some football calls we'll get to now. The talk about the baseball locals, though, right around the corner. But let's get Ira in Staten Island up to talk about the Jets this morning here on 98.7 ESPN. Hello, Ira.
Hey, good morning, Bob. Good morning, Chris. You know, I couldn't agree with you both. Listen, yeah, any Jet fan would have to be naive to think this is a one-year fix. And, you know, I think they're making progress this year. We'll see how this plays out. But, you know, to address the secondary like you were just both talking about, I think part of it, he can't do everything in 1 year, like you said. Number two, from what I've heard, next year's draft is very top-heavy in secondary people. So I'm sure Douglas is focusing, like Bob, you said, with the picks next year, to whatever guys don't pan out this year. But also, and I said this to Chris, you know, leading into the May and how that whole thing played out, I really truly believe that Salah, you know, they're so, like, convicted with this front seven getting pressure. Now, I know you have to have some type of quality secondary people, but I also think Douglas is not going to go out and spend crazy on corners. First of all, in today's NFL, there's no such thing as a lockdown corner. There's a handful of guys, but the days of Revis are over. The game and the way the rules and the penalties, he just can't play the way he played. And number two, I think his allocations are going to be more towards the offensive line and defensive line and his skill position. And his secondary, he's going to judge and hope he's going to hit on it in his draft, because I don't think he's ever really going to spend big in the secondary.
Well, I don't know that he's never going to spend big in the secondary. I just don't think it makes a whole lot of sense for the Jets to do so right now based on where this team is at. The Jets are not going to be competing for the AFC East title this year. That's not going to happen. This team is a couple of years away, and so I just think it doesn't make sense to tie up your cap flexibility for whatever options that were going to be out there in the free agent marketplace this particular offseason with the secondary, especially with cornerbacks. Like, this is one of those things that you can address in the future with your draft capital and seeing what happens in the NFL with some of the veteran quarters that might be available in the next free agency cycle. But right now, it doesn't make sense for the Jets to do that, which is why Joe Douglas and Rob Saleh are standing pat.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's going to be very interesting to see how Saleh, if the front seven can generate the pressure, how he's going to have disguises or zones, or if he's going to be able to play man-to-man with the inexperience that he has back there.
Yeah, I guess I would answer that question. If he can't generate pressure on the opposing quarterback with his front seven, they're in big, big trouble.
Yes.
You're not schematically going to, with this secondary, cover for the fact that you can't get to the quarterback. They have no chance. So the pressure will be on the front seven guys to at least make the opposing quarterback uncomfortable to give a young secondary a fighting chance in coverage. But I guess I'd say two things about how I think the Jets are going to approach the secondary. Number one, this is only year two. It feels like Joe Douglas has been here for a decade. This is only his second year of spending any money or drafting any players. He's got four more years on his contract after this season.
Yeah, he's got four more years on his contract, but he is going into year four. Like, he would be going into year four after this season. Like, it's Joe Douglas has to make some strides in terms of where this team is at. Like, we've got to see some tangible evidence that they're on the right track. Because right now, it's Joe Douglas just undoing everything that Mike Maccagnan did when he was building his team, him and Todd Bowles. Like, now we're starting to see that this is Joe Douglas's team, and so we got to start seeing some fruit come from that, Bob.
There's no doubt, but this is still, we have yet to see his second draft class even play a snap. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, it feels like he's been here because he got the job right after Mike Maccagnan had a draft class and spent all the money 3 years ago. So it feels like he's been here longer than he actually has in terms of his ability to put his thumbprint on this team. It's only his second draft class, only his second free agent class.
Third season on the job, though, right?
Right. Yep. So, you know, I do think that he is taking still the long game view here. That's why he didn't go out and throw a bunch of money at the secondary this year. You know, I think that it's kind of like the old theory, you can't have everything you want right away. So he believes, and I think, Chris, you'd probably agree, that the way you build a good, sustainable winner in the NFL is really through the draft. Right? Having a whole bunch of cap space. We always go into the offseason, oh, this team's got all this cap space. They've got all this money to spend. If you have $70 million in cap space, that's not a good thing.
No, that just means you don't have homegrown talent that you're signing the contract.
Correct.
That's all that means.
That's it. You know who doesn't have $70 million in cap space? The Chiefs. They don't have $70 million in cap space.
The Steelers. They don't have $70 million in cap space.
Correct, because they've got guys on their team that they want to pay because they're worth the money. If you have $70 million in cap space, that's basically an announcement to the league. We drafted a whole bunch of guys that aren't worth paying any money to. So the goal is to have that cap space there so that when these guys you draft become the players you hope they'll be, you pay them with your cap space. So that's why I don't think he's going to go out at any point, at any position, and go on some giant spending spree and bring in like three, you know, $20 million corners. I don't think he's doing that. I think what he is hoping to do is use all the draft capital that he's had and accrued, with the Jamal Adams trade being the centerpiece of it, and address it that way going forward. And if you're going to do it in the draft, and that really, I think, is the way to do it, you can't do it all in 1 year. You know, something on a team this devoid of talent was going to be neglected, and it turned out that, as the board shook out, corner was the spot that had to be neglected, at least for now. That's just the way it goes.
Well, here's the thing. The Jets needed everything this offseason. Like, they needed everything.
Yes.
So I think that gave Joe Douglas a tremendous amount of flexibility in terms of formulating his plan. But based on how everything went down with what we saw they did in free agency and what they did in the draft, I think you have to give him an A grade, because that's how you're supposed to build a team. Like, you're drafting a franchise quarterback, so you had to be able to put yourself in position to do that. They did that with Zach Wilson. They were able to fortify the offensive line by moving up in the draft, having the capital, having the agility to do that, and got Elijah Vera Tucker. So, I mean, you got some skill position players that should be able to contribute early to your quarterback in Michael Carter and Elijah Moore. Like you feel good about the things that they did. In free agency, they went out and got Keelan Cole. They went out and got Corey Davis to add to that receiving core. That's going to make life a lot easier for Zach Wilson. And on the defensive side of the ball, you get some defensive linemen to try to fortify your front seven. So I feel good about the plan that he executed, just because if you're going to have a successful football team, you got to address the line of scrimmage, the offensive and defensive line, and you got to address the quarterback position. I think the Jets did that in a big way this offseason. Now, with that being said, there's pressure on Joe Douglas this year to have some tangible results from the moves that he's made the last couple of years. Like, we have to see that this team is on the right track. And I compare it to kind of what we saw from the Giants last year, and the fact that you knew that this was a different team than the guys that we saw in Giants uniforms in the 4 years prior under Ben McAdoo and Pat Shurmur. Like, you knew that that was a different Giants team. You saw that there was a difference in terms of the culture, the air around the team. That's what you need to see and feel from the Jets in 2021. That's what I want Joe Douglas and Rob Saleh to show me. Like, that's when I'll have confidence that you got the right general manager and the right head coach to lead this organization into the future. That's what I'm looking for.
We've been giving you the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. Let's get Charlie in Staten Island in here on DCR on 98.7 ESPN. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, what's going on, guys? I got to tell you, the confidence I have in the Jets these last years have been the lowest they've ever been. The way they did Sam Darnold, just traded him out of nowhere. This kid, Zach Wilson, not going to do good. tell you this much. Now, I think the Panthers are going to scrape the floor with the Jets this year. I'm just sick of every year the same song and dance. Oh, we got these draft picks. Oh, we got all this cap space. What are you ever going to do with it? How long is the team going to be in the rebuild station? 20 years straight.
To say the Jets have been rebuilding for 20 years is not true. Like, about 11 years ago, they went to back-to-back championship games. I get the frustration. I absolutely understand. I don't want to keep on hearing about the future, about the draft picks we have coming, about the salary cap space we have coming. Sooner or later, you want fruits of that labor to show up?
Yes,
because
I've been saying
this, and again, this is the Straight Talk brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless. No contract, no compromise. Just because, like, Jet fans right now want to hear the word rebuild the way the 4-year-old wants to see broccoli on his dinner plate. Right? It's good for you, but they don't want to eat it. They're sick of, like, they want an ice cream sundae. They want to be the Chiefs. They want dessert. They want to finally get to a Super Bowl. They want to win, and I totally understand that. But just because the rebuilds of John Idzik and Mike McCadden didn't work doesn't change the reality that Joe Douglas is facing now. In fact, it creates that reality. Right? Like, you can't be, as Joe Douglas, a general manager, to look and say, well, the last two guys were here, they tried to rebuild, it didn't work, so I'm going to try and win in 1 year, because I understand that fans are frustrated. No. If anything, it creates the reality of you have to rebuild, because you're not only doing what the last two general managers tried to do, and you now have to do, but you're now also paying for the mistakes that were made before you arrived. So, look, I get it. Rebuild is... Right? It's like asparagus, right? Like, I mean, a little kid doesn't want to see it. Like, you're tired of it. But it doesn't change the reality that it exists. Look at the roster. It's going to take some time for them to get the roster to the point where it can win.
Well, here's the thing, right? I mean, Joe Douglas asked for a 6-year contract when he took the job for a reason.
Yep,
like,
he knew
that it was going to take some time to strip this thing down to bare bones and then to build it back up the way that he felt the football team should be built, comparable to what we saw with the Philadelphia Eagles and the Baltimore Ravens, you know, when they're building championship contenders, because those are the organizations that he came from. Like, we understand that. But, I mean, ultimately, what's going to decide whether or not Joe Douglas was a successful general manager for the New York Jets is how Zach Wilson fares. Like, if Zach Wilson turns out to be the guy that leads the Jets under center for the next decade and a half, then everybody's going to feel great about Joe Douglas. Everybody's going to love Joe Douglas. But if Zach Wilson turns out to have a career trajectory similar to what we saw from Sam Darnold his first 3 years, then he's going to be run out of town sooner rather than later. Like, that's just how it goes. Like, that second pick in this year's draft is going to be so important. And especially when you view it through the lens of all the other quarterbacks that were taken in the first round, too. I mean, let's not forget, I mean, there were three other quarterbacks that got drafted in the first round after Zach Wilson. And so a part of how we feel about Joe Douglas and the job that he's doing is going to be, okay, how does Zach Wilson look in comparison to his contemporaries? Now, you might say that that's unfair because, you know, Trey Lance is in a better situation, or Justin Fields is in a better situation, or Mac Jones is in a better situation. But, I mean, you know, fans can't apply that logic all the time. Like, fans want to say, you know what, we feel good about Zach Wilson. That was the right choice by Joe Douglas when you look at the other quarterbacks that we're comparing him to in his draft class. Like, that's going to tell the tale in terms of whether or not Joe Douglas has done the job, whether or not Zach Wilson turns out to be the guy.
That's it. I mean, the quarterback that you are married to as a general manager creates your legacy more than, as a coach, creates your legacy and shapes your career more than any other singular decision that you're going to make. And there, it's, you know, it's pretty clear that Joe Douglas has hitched his wagon to Zach Wilson.
Thanks for listening to the DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg podcast.
You're absolutely right.
Catch the show on demand wherever and whenever you want. Just subscribe to us, rate us, and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Bob Wischusen sitting in for Dave Rothenberg, I guess. I don't know who the Rick DiPietro is on this show. I can't be both, but at least we got Chris Canty, right? Like, I mean, that changes, you know, the class.
All right, here
of the
we
show.
Go, Feather.
Well, I think you're both of them rolled up in one. B.O.P.
I know, you can't be.
You're Rick DiPietro and you're Dave Rothenberg.
I got some sexy undies.
You're a gambling degenerate that loves to weave in innuendo throughout the show.
There you go.
There
absolutely.
You go.
You know what I'm wondering? You know, you talk about, like, as a football player, training camp. What do you do training camp-wise? You know what? This probably applies to Rick as well. What do you guys have to do mentally to prepare yourselves to get ready to spend a football season with Dave Rothenberg?
I saw a picture of his body.
Mentally.
I don't think there's anything that you can do to get ready to prepare yourself for a Dave Rothenberg-led football season. I don't think there's anything out there to prep for. Like, there's nothing that would get you in the frame of mind to be able to put up with some of the stuff that Dave does, especially when the Giants are in disrepair. Like, that's one of those things. Like, it's Dave Rothenberg, when the Giants are bad, just he goes insane. Now, last couple of years, it hasn't been as bad because they've sucked the life out of him as a fan, because you're talking about double-digit loss season upon double-digit loss season. But this past year was the first time that we actually saw, like, the fire and the fandom from Dave Rothenberg come back. Like, this was the first time since the boat trip that we actually saw an impassioned Dave Rothenberg. So it's exciting to see. But it's also kind of scary because he's liable to do anything.
See, that's exactly what I was wondering. As a talk show host now, you live in this world where we're talking to the fans. We're talking to the crazies, right? I mean, you sit next to one every morning, or I guess you hopefully will start to sit next to one again soon. But Dave Rothenberg's nuts. When you were playing, are you guys acutely aware of how many people out there, their entire lives are rolled up, happiness or sadness, and whether or not you guys are winning football games?
No, you're not thinking about that, Bob. Like, you're thinking about how you can do your job. Like, you have the level of awareness that you have with the fan base is, like, if you're not going out there and you're not competing and you're just getting blown out, like, you know the fans are they're going to be disappointed. And the great thing about playing in New York is you don't have to wait all that long for the reaction, because they'll tell you when you're in the damn stadium. But, I mean, like, that's about as far as it goes. You don't realize how much fans are living and dying with your team's, you know, results, whether you're winning or whether you're losing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't realize it until I started doing this job and just hearing all of the Giants fans that are calling into our show. And it just seems like every week somebody calls in and says, "Hey, Chris, thank you for the Super Bowl." And it just realized that that's something that happened 10 years ago, and Giants fans are still thanking me for it. So it's just one of those things. You don't have that level of awareness while you're actually in it, though. You know what I'm saying? You get caught up in your day-to-day on what it takes to do your job and give your team a chance to compete and be successful. Yeah, you're not thinking about the fans that much.
30 years from now, 40 years from now, they will still be thanking you for that Super Bowl. Like, when a Super Bowl is won for a fan base, especially in New York, and I mean, right, like, I was not born when the Jets won their only Super Bowl, but I have been surrounded during my entire Jet career by alumni of that team, and senior citizens will come up to those guys, because they're all senior citizens now, and thank them for Super Bowl III. Thank them for 1969. So that never goes away. But I remember getting the Jets, even the pre- and post-game job. So this is 25 years ago. I mean, I'm 25, 26 years old, and I'm walking into the stadium, you know, 3-4 hours before the game starts. And there is, I remember passing a guy, the first regular season Sunday of the year, passing a guy who had to be in his mid-50s, late-50s. It's 4 hours before the game's going to start. This guy is stuffed into, like, a Wayne Krebet jersey that's three sizes too small. He is alone in his car, and in the rearview mirror, he is painting his face. He's by himself, but he is getting his game face on. He's painting his face. And I remember being, like, 25 years old, walking in thinking to myself, it's guys like that. That's why I've got a job.
Yeah,
like, we only get to work in this industry because there are people out there that care that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never be able to wrap my head around it. I'll never totally be able to understand what gets the 58-year-old guy who's been going to games for 30 years to get to the parking lot 4 or 5 hours before the game and think what's really important right now is I got to paint my face. I have to put makeup on or else these guys might not win today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody is superstitious around sports. Like, if you're in sports or if you love sports, you're a fan of sports, like, everybody has those superstitions, right? Like, you have to sit a certain way when you're watching the game, or you have to watch the game with a certain group of people, or you got to have a particular jersey on, or you got to have, you know, this thing or that thing. Like, that, everybody has that. Like, even players, like Like, I got to have a pair of certain socks or a pair of cleats or, you know, I got to have this, you know. There are certain things that you have to have in order to feel like, okay, I'm ready to go, whether you're watching it or whether you're playing it. But as far as we go, like the players or doing this job, Bob, like you can't appreciate the gravity of what it means to the fans in terms of you going out there and winning games. Like you just you can't have that kind of appreciation for it while you're in it. Like you got to take a step back. You got to be out of it to see how much it actually means to the fans out there what you do on a week in, week out basis. So it's pretty cool to have this vantage point now and to know how, you know, how important it was to fans while I was playing, while I was wearing the Giants jersey, like what it meant to them and being able to deliver that championship.
Yeah, got sidetracked there. I just, for some reason, it's stuck in my head. I have to know what it's like to be a talk show host preparing for a football season mentally when you know Dave Rothenberg is the guy you're going to be spending 5 days a week with.
He's a lunatic.
He is a lunatic in the best possible way.
Oh, my God.
That's not even a language he's speaking right there. Like, you don't even understand that.
Thanks for listening to the DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg podcast.
I don't wake up at 4 a.m. to wear a swim shirt.
Looking for more access to the show? Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at DCR on ESPN.
But we have yet to even touch on the baseball locals. And, boy, you want to talk about the soap
opera. I'm glad
opera.
We haven't touched on them because I'm a Yankees fan. But
I know. Yeah. I want to get
Ain't
to that.
There's a whole lot of positives we got to talk about right now.
I'm going to say something, though, that I'm wondering might give you a little bit of hope. So Herm Edwards, when he was the coach of the Jets, this is 20 years ago when I first met him, the Jets had this really old football team that Bill Parcells had left behind, but they had been a playoff team. They had gone to the 98 championship game. And I remember talking to Herm, and he said, you know, when he came in, he sat down with Woody Johnson, he said, you know, you got an old football team. And Woody Johnson was like, what are you talking about? We're just in the championship game a couple of years ago. Like, we're a playoff team. So, look, we can take one more run at it with this group if you want, but you have an old football team that's going to have to be torn apart at some point and built back up. And Woody was like, really? He said, look, Woody, and he told us the story. So, look, there's perception and there's reality. The perception of your team is you just went to the championship game a couple of years ago. You got all these household names. You got Mo Lewis and Marvin Jones and Vinny Testaverde and on, Curtis Martin. But, like you need help. You need youth. You need young players. That's the reality of it. And what I'm wondering is, can you apply perception versus reality to the New York baseball locals and how both teams have to be clear-eyed about what they have to do this week? Because it's funny. Like you said, the Yankees right now are a dumpster fire. Right? Like, Brian Cashman might get fired, and Aaron Boone, the entire fan base is going to call for his head. The Mets are darlings. The Mets are a first-place team, and they're winning games late. Jeff McNeil last night with more dramatics. The Yankees are 51-47. The Mets are 53-45. And their records are almost identical. If the Yankees win two in a row and the Mets lose two in a row, they'll have the same record. The Mets just happen to be in baseball's version of the NFC East. So I think perception is the Mets are on the rise. Everything's hunky-dory. They could be a challenger as a first-place team in their division, maybe win the World Series. The Yankees tear it down. It's over. Fire the manager. Start from scratch. They are separated by two games, perception versus reality. So, Chris, I would say this to you as a Yankee fan. What do you want to see them do this week? Right? Like, what's the reality for the Yankees? What can they do as they head towards the trade deadline to still go into a wild card race where they're inside of a handful of games behind? They could very easily be the second wild card. Is this season salvageable? I think it is.
Well, no, I'm not going to say it's not salvageable in terms of them being a wild card team, but we thought that based on what the Yankees did in the first couple of weeks of the second half, they could have an opportunity to contend in the AL East, and it feels like that ship has all but sailed with what happened up in Fenway Park this weekend, losing 3 or 4 to the Red Sox. I mean, you had a couple of bullpen meltdowns that were just disgusting, the latest of which was what happened on Sunday with Jonathan Loaisiga, and you would even question why he was even in the game because, yep, you know, you wonder why you pulled Domingo Germán out after he just gives up one double. Like, it just felt like he was cruising up until that point, but, you know, based on what they do with the analytics and the numbers, they tell him once the pitch count gets to a certain point, we got to pull him, we got to go to the bullpen, and Loaisiga just didn't have it. Now, I don't know why they stayed with Jonathan Loaisiga as long as they did either. I know there's that three-batter minimum, but once you got through 7, 8, 9 in the Red Sox order and you saw that he was struggling, all three of those batters reached base, it probably would have made sense to go to somebody else in the bullpen before the damn thing got out of hand. But that's one of those decisions that you'll always look back and second guess Aaron Boone on because you didn't get the result that you wanted. So off day, now you got a three-game set with the Tampa Bay Rays. We'll see what happens with that. But if you were thinking that the Yankees had a chance to contend in the AL East Division for the title, like it feels like that's like we're past that now. Like that's gone. Depending on what happens with this series, I mean, you can go ahead and slam the door on that. But that still gives you an opportunity with the wild card. I mean, the team that you're looking at is the Oakland A's. And the rumor has it that they're going to be in the Chris Bryant trade market. So you know that they're going to try to bolster their team to make a playoff push. I mean, that's the team that you got circled right now if you're the Yankees trying to make sure that you can keep pace with and gain ground on. But as far as the moves go before the deadline, I don't know that there's just one move out there. But, I mean, the Yankees, I mean, you could use some help with your bullpen. You could use some help in terms of being able to bring some more punch to your lineup. We'll see what they end up doing. I heard that they're in on Trevor Story. We'll see if anything materializes with that. But, I mean, Bob, I'm at the point now where I feel like this team needs to make a significant move just for the sake of being able to inject some more life into them.
I agree 100%. A Trevor Story, another right-handed bat. I don't know if that's the direction you want to go. But on the flip side, here was Jeff Passan on SportsCenter talking about how the Yankees view themselves and whether or not they're going to make any moves we head towards the trade deadline. Jeff Passan.
The Yankees are far beyond striving for perfection at this point. They're just clawing on for life. And in an American League East where there are two teams that are clearly better than them, and a third in the Toronto Blue Jays that has a run differential 81 runs higher than the Yankees at this point, of course they want to get better, but the question is at what price for a team that, while it's only 3.5 games out of the second wild card spot, nobody looks at these New York Yankees and says, this looks like a team that's going to win a championship this year. And I think the Yankees are honestly recognizing that themselves, because whereas in the past they might go out and be more aggressive to try and improve a team like this, this is not necessarily a team you're going to see going out and trading for a number of frontline guys. They could theoretically get a Trevor Story to fill in at shortstop, move Gleyber Torres over to second, move DJ LeMahieu to first, but I think the chances of the Yankees going out and making multiple big splashes and really trying to chase a playoff spot at this point aren't very high.
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I'm with them on that one. I mean, right now, Baseball Reference has the playoff odds for the Yankees at 13%. So it's not looking too great for the home team. And I know it's 3.5 games, but I look at the teams that they're chasing in Tampa and Oakland, and I just – those teams have shown me that they're consistently playing better baseball than the Yankees. I mean, right now, the Rays are, what, 20 games over 500? The Oakland A's are 11 games over 500? The Yankees are 4 games over 500. I mean, there's clearly a difference in terms of the quality of the baseball team. Now, I'm not looking at just the pieces that you have, but overall how they've been playing, how they've been producing. Now, it felt like the Yankees kind of got something when those young guys were called into duty because you had so many guys out with COVID right after the All-Star break. The Allens of the world, Lamar, like those guys, it felt like they gave this team a little more enthusiasm, a little more energy, because the Yankees didn't feel like a team that was playing with a lot of urgency, and those guys showed up and provided that. But the question is, are they going to be able to have that when they get the regulars back in the lineup? Are they going to be able to have that same type of play with that same type of desperation when those guys get back? I don't know. That remains to be seen, but I will say this. This set against the Rays would be a great time for them to show up and do that.
I mean, they're a flawed team. I get it. They're 3.5 games out of a wild card spot. How do you punt How do you punt on a season or just stand pat?
They're not going to punt. They're not going to punt on the season. They're not going to punt on the season. I mean, they have a top three payroll. There's no way that there's going to be this massive sell-off before Friday. They're going to add pieces. The question is, what are they going to add? Like, who are they going to target? How are they going to improve this team? That's what remains to be seen from Brian Cashman. I mean, there are some holes that they could plug. I mean, you could go after bullpen help. You could go after another starter. Like, you can go after – like, there's things on this team that you have to try to fix or to have to try to upgrade. So the question becomes, what's the deal that makes the most sense for Brian Cashman in order to put this team where he thinks they need to be in order to make a run at that wild card spot?
And on the flip side with the Mets, I'm interested to hear what Zach Scott, the general manager, said about their philosophy heading to the trade deadline, because we have a cut of the Met GM talking about whether or not they think they need to make trades to be a World Series contender. You guys want to play that, Zach Scott? No, sorry, it's the Zach Scott, the first cut of Zach Scott talking about whether or not they're going to make trades to possibly be a World Series contender.
Yeah, I think you're always thinking of both. I don't think there's a clear criteria for, you know, how do you make the team not just a postseason contender, but a champion, you know, get a championship winner. I mean, it's hard to clearly define that. So we really need to just focus on how we make the team better, and that's going to help our odds of winning a championship. So, but that's the goal. So we're always thinking that way too, is, you know, how does this team look come October? You know, we want to get there because that's the first step. And then, you know, once we're there, what does our team look like that's a little different than maybe a regular season team just because of the way the postseason works? And so definitely have to think about both ways.
All right, it's early. I didn't get a lot of sleep. You didn't get a lot of sleep. I mean, I'm pounding the coffee, doing the best I can. Do you have any idea what he just said?
I don't. And Zach,
like, that was like word salad. I didn't even know what that even meant.
And Zach Scott is masterful at throwing out his responses and framing them in the way of a question. But, I mean, listen, the Mets are one of those teams right now that you feel like are going to be major players ahead of Friday.
They better be.
They feel like they're going to go big game hunting. Like, they feel like they're going to go after the Chris Bryants of the world. I think they're the odds-on favorite to land Chris Bryant. I mean, Barrios is one of those guys that you would like to see them add with their starting rotation. Javi Baez's name has come up in terms of being able to add him and let him be one of your middle infielders, especially knowing that Francisco Lindor is 3 to 5 weeks out. So, I mean, it feels like the Mets are going to be really aggressive before the deadline, and like you said, they absolutely should be, because this is a team right now that's in the driver's seat for the NL East. Like, it's their division to lose. It doesn't feel like there's anybody that's intent on trying to catch up with them. I like the fact that they were able to go out and add a guy like Rich Hill, who in his Mets debut was able to give him 5 innings, a 3-run ball, and they came out with a win. Like, that was a good move. But, I mean, there's still a lot more to do in terms of making sure that this team is not only a team that can win a division and secure a playoff spot, but a team that could be capable of going on a little bit of a run.
Yeah, see, I look at it the other way, and maybe as a Met fan, you're tuned to maybe expect the disappointing result. You say it looks like they're in the driver's seat to win the National League East. I kind of feel like they're a house of cards unless they go out and help themselves, because they're 53-45, 8 games over. They have a run differential this season of plus 11. Right, like same as the Yankees. They're barely over 500, and they played 14 innings of baseball last night, and in 14 innings,
they scored one run, yeah,
and still found a way to split, still found a way to get a win.
Yeah.
To me, that sums up the Mets season, right? Like, that is almost like an encapsulation of what the whole year has been. As exciting as it's been, as incredible as it's been again to watch DeGrom, as good as the bullpen has been, as great as they've been defensively, I mean, Lindor, as lousy as he's been at the plate, he's a masterful defensive player.
Yep.
It still feels like they are a team that could be caught by the Phillies and have a very disappointing end of the season. Pete Alonso hitting a couple of home runs at home. That's very encouraging. Michael Conforto's back in the weeds. Dom Smith has had a couple of flashes this year. He's been nothing like he was in the shortened season last year. Lindor's hurt. They need a bat. They are in a position now where you can't, I think, fool yourselves. Like, I go back to the Herm Edwards thing, perception versus reality. You can't fool yourselves that being 53-45 in this division puts you anywhere near the class of the teams out west, or even the Brewers, who are 16 games over, and are, they have a 65-run differential. The Mets have an 11-run differential. So I think the Mets have to really be clear-eyed about, in spite of the fact that they are winning their lousy division, how good they really are. They owe their fans, I think, a big trade by the time we get. They owe their fans Chris Bryant. They owe their fans Javi Baez. They owe their fans, I think, a move that helps them go out and take advantage of the opportunity that they have created for themselves, at least to this point.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. If they don't win this division, it would be a huge disappointment. Like a huge disappointment. So, yeah, I don't think the Mets, you know, have any misconception about who or what they are. The one thing that I will say about their struggles, especially on the offensive side of things, is that in the first half of this season, you had so many guys out of your lineup. Like, you, I don't know how many games the Mets played with all of their guys that they came into the season dependent on in their lineup, but I mean, you're talking about big pieces of your lineup missing significant portions of the first half. Jeff McNeil was out for a really long time. Michael Conforto was out for a long time. Pete Alonso had an IL stint. Like, you had guys missing, big parts of your lineup missing significant time. So it just feels like the Mets, up until that Francisco Lindor thing happened, were on their way in terms of their guys all being in the lineup and all clicking, and clicking on all cylinders. Like, I just feel like there will be an opportunity for that in the second half, and if they can just tread water until that point, the Mets will be fine. But
you're right.
Because of the Lindor injury, I feel like they have to be aggressive in going out and finding somebody that can bring some more production from that position, just because this team has a real chance to get something done. Because let me say this, Bob, if the Mets get in the playoffs, this is a team that nobody wants to face if their starting pitching rotation is healthy. Nobody wants to go up against Jacob DeGrom, Marcus Stroman, and the combination of Taijuan Walker or Cookie Carrasco or Noah Syndergaard. Nobody's going to want to see that.
Yep.
Nobody.
That's a good point. That's Chris Canty. I'm Bob Wischusen, DCR on 98.7 ESPN. 800-919-3776 is the telephone number. 800-919-ESPN. We'll get back to the phones in a sec, and we want to remind you that Live Nation presents Jason Aldean on Friday, August 6th at PNC Bank Arts Center, and Saturday, August 7th at the Northwell Health at Jones Beach Theater. Tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Be listening later on at today's show for your chance to score a pair of tickets to see Jason Aldean live at your choice of PNC Bank Arts Center or Jones Beach Theater, all from Live Nation, and you're home for the hookup, 98.7 ESPN. As a longtime listener of DCR, you know how excited I am right now? I get to be a part of, like, when I'm in the car and I'm listening to you guys and, you know, I hear the CMT intro. I'm like, I would love to be a part of that. I get to be a part of it right now with RJ.
To cuddle.
I'll tell you what, Rico. I can chase him down. Aww. I'll hold him down for you.
To marry.
I don't want to give up the meat.
Or to trash.
I think I'm emotionally broken.
That is the question.
Love it.
Yes. I'm looking at our friend Mike Tannenbaum on KJZ right now. He's on the television. One AirPod Pro in, one out. Look at
him. Oh, he's got it all going.
It's a real pro.
Right? Nice little tan. Look at Mike T. Ready to roll.
All right. And we are ready to roll as well. So you guys are talking about the Mets, and that's where we begin. Chris Bryant, that's the name we're going to focus on. He's the big name on the radar, if you ask Mets fans. Trade deadline coming on Friday. I'll ask you this. And we'll start with Chris. Cuddle, marry, or trash, where Bryant is post-deadline? The Cubs, the Mets, or somewhere else?
I am going to say he's going to end up in Oakland. And it's one of those things. I know Chris Bryant would fit a huge need for the Mets at third base, but I just feel like the Mets are going to address other things. I think that they're probably intent on finding somebody that can give them some production at the shortstop position beyond what Guillorme has been able to give them. So I think it's going to end up being Javi Baez, the position player that the Mets prioritize over Chris Bryant. So I'm going to say Bryant ends up somewhere else. So I'll marry that. I will cuddle with the Mets, and I will trash ending up staying pat with the Cubs.
I'm going to go the other way, and maybe this is just me being a wishful Mets fan. I'm going to marry the Mets. I want him to get him. I think they've got the firepower to go get him. I guess I'll cuddle him going somewhere else, maybe Oakland. And I'll trash staying with the Cubs because I think the Cubs are in a position now where they're going to tear it down.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. If Dave were here, he would applaud me for finding the divisiveness between the two of you.
Of course. That's what we got to do.
Because otherwise I would be ripped apart for any agreement whatsoever. But you guys are nice to me. So we move on. We haven't touched on this, but you guys are both college football guys. We don't spend a ton of time on it. Bob, big time college football broadcaster. And Chris played the game, so you know. Oklahoma and Texas are fleeing the Big 12. Sights set on the SEC. Now, I know from a dollar standpoint, it makes all the sense in the world. I get that. But if we look at it from a competitive standpoint, just football for now. I know it's basketball, other sports, just football, though. Cuddle, marry, or trash how Oklahoma and Texas will fare in the big boy SEC. Will they struggle? Will they blend in? Or will they excel?
Bob, this is on you. You go first this time.
I'll cuddle. That's a good question. I mean, I think they're going to struggle.
Two for two, RJ.
At least at the start. I think, yeah. It's a really good question. I think Oklahoma and Texas, I have to take them individually because they're in a different place as programs, right? I mean, with, you know, like Oklahoma's been in the college football playoff. Texas hasn't really been a relevant team. They fired coaches since Mack Brown left. So if I were going to go Oklahoma individually, I will marry that they will blend at the start. I think they're going to blend because I think it's hard to stand out with Alabama, Auburn, Georgia. I mean, the depth of the SEC is brutal. I guess I will cuddle that they will excel, and I'll trash that they'll struggle. I don't think Oklahoma is going to be like the next Vanderbilt. Texas, on the other hand, they really need a talent infusion in that program to make me convinced they're going to be able to even compete in the SEC. So I think at least at the start, I'm going to marry that they are going to struggle. And then I'm going to cuddle that they will blend, and I'll trash that they'll excel. Because I think Oklahoma is a much more prepared program right now to go to the SEC and compete.
I love how Bob is changing things on the fly. He's just going to extrapolate OU from the OU-Texas conversation when it comes to who's going to struggle, blend in, or who's going to excel. I'm going to take them as a package deal, like RJ framed the question. The only thing that I would have a question about is which division the OU-Texas tandem would end up in, just because if they're with Alabama, I'm going to marry struggle. So let's just put that out there. I'm going to marry struggle. I am going to cuddle blend in. And I am going to trash excel. Like the NFL is, I mean, the SEC is the developmental league for the NFL. And if you watch Big 12 football, it's defense optional. They play defense in the SEC. So I don't see either one of these teams jumping into this conference and excelling immediately.
Agreed.
Just not going to happen.
So we'll move on quickly, but I guess a quick trivia question for you. The Big 12 came together in 96. Do you know how many times Texas has won the Big 12?
Football-wise?
Yes.
Zero, right? Or maybe once?
Maybe once.
Three.
Okay.
Oklahoma has won it 14 times.
Yeah. I mean, they're totally different ends of the spectrum since Mack Brown left as programs.
Isn't that crazy, though? Your first instinct was, have they won it? And it's Texas. It's Texas football.
Yeah.
Moving on. Team USA men's basketball back in action tomorrow against Iran. A game that the U.S. is favored by to win by 40 points. I'm assuming the U.S. will win that game. But let's reassess here. What we've seen from Team USA so far, expectations for Team USA the rest of the way. Gold medal, silver medal, or bronze or worse?
Oh, boy.
Go ahead, CeCe.
Man, okay. I am going to... I mean, it's hard to marry them winning a gold medal after they struggled the way that they have early, right? Losing to France, and I mean, earlier in the exhibition, losing to Nigeria. I mean, it's just, I don't know how you marry it. I will cuddle them winning a gold medal. I will marry them winning a silver medal, and I will trash them winning bronze or worse. Like, I still want to believe in Team USA, even though they haven't really given us a whole lot of things to hold on to as fans, as Americans. It's something, man. I feel like Pop has just got to stop trying to force them to play this whole share the basketball concept thing and just allow them to play ISO ball and do what they do best. Like, I mean, they're not going to be able to compete with the international teams playing the brand of basketball where everybody's touching it every single possession. That's not who they are. They're stars. Let them be stars. Let them go out there and do their thing. If Pop does that, then I think that they'll get the results that they're looking for.
Yep, no disagreement here. I am right with you. I am going to cuddle them winning the gold. I'm going to marry them winning the silver. And I'll trash them winning the bronze or worse. Like, I mean, they're the most talented team. Anytime the U.S. puts an international true basketball product on the floor, they're going to be the most talented team. But they're by far not the most talented team gap-wise or difference-wise from what it used to be. So, You know, to me, yeah. And I think that you see team chemistry matters.
Yes.
You see the fact
yes.
that in a lot of these international programs, all of these NBA players whose names you know, when they go back to play for their national teams, the fact that they play with their countrymen in these FIBA tournaments, that being on those national teams, growing up on those national teams, means something. Those guys, from a team chemistry standpoint, just kind of fall back into it, whereas we think we're going to take all these guys that have never played together, chuck them all together, ball them up, and turn it into this all-star game. And, you know, they had Bird and Magic and Michael and Malone and Stockton. I mean, that worked because the talent disparity was so significant back then. The talent disparity is not nearly as significant now as it was back then, A. And B, these international teams have some chemistry that the U.S. just doesn't have.
Yeah, we had Team USA treated the Olympics like Chris Canty treated Vegas in the show. Just red-eyed back and forth. You know, I saw the private, what do they call it, Blade? The private chopper landed on the West Side Highway. Chris Ubered over here. That's how I think he got here. I'm not sure.
Wow. Look at you, RJ. Putting a lot on it, my man.
All right, last one. Rookie ratings for Madden. They are coming out slowly. The highest rated overall rookie so far. We don't have all the quarterbacks yet or all the position players, but the highest rated rookie so far is Kyle Pitts. He's at 81. The top rated quarterback, you'd probably guess, Trevor Lawrence, 78. And you're probably wondering where Zach Wilson is. He's second at 75. To note, Trey Lance, Justin Fields are 74. So,
like, are those numbers good? Like, I'm not a video game guy.
They're not awesome, but they're good.
What's the high? Like, are there guys that, like, in the upper 90s? Is there somebody who's like 100? Like,
what, you got the 99 club.
Like, Devontae Adams is a 99.
Well, they actually call it the 99 club.
The 99 club.
All right.
Yeah, they don't give out hundos.
Got it.
One day they will. That'll be news. But so I think I know where you'll go for Mary, but I'm curious how the other two play out here. So cuddle Mary trash. Offensive rookie of the year will use the highest three rated rookies so far in the game on offense. Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson, and Kyle Pitts.
I mean, to me, you always have to lean towards the quarterbacks because the quarterbacks are going to put up the numbers that usually go along with winning those kind of awards. So I would probably marry Trevor Lawrence. I might cuddle Zach Wilson. And even though I think Kyle Pitts could be the most transformational talent of any player in this past year's draft, I don't know. Do I see a tight end winning the NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year? It's a good question. I guess I'll trash Kyle Pitts, but I mean, I think he's going to be an amazing player.
Well, I will say this. The Atlanta Falcons drafted Kyle Pitts with the fourth overall pick with a bunch of quarterbacks still left on the board. So, I mean, if you could try to make a case for a guy to win it at that position, it would be Kyle Pitts just because you know they're going to try to justify it by using the hell out of that guy. But I'm with you. I'm with you, B.O.B., on who I'm going to marry. There is full-blown love when it comes to Trevor Lawrence winning Offensive Rookie of the Year. I'm going to marry him. I am going to cuddle up next to Kyle Pitts winning Offensive Rookie of the Year. And I'm going to trash Zach Wilson winning Offensive Rookie of the Year. Not because I don't think he's going to be good, just because I think it's going to be an uphill climb when you look at the AFC East and some of the head coaches that he's going to deal with. Three of the best defensive minds in the game in Bill Belichick, Brian Flores, and Sean McDermott. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a struggle early for him. It's going to make it hard for him to win Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Love CMT.
Thanks for listening to the DPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg podcast.
I have nothing left.
Hear more of DPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg live weekday mornings from 5 to 8 a.m. on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
Hey, Alexa, play ESPN New York 98.7.